Welcome to this podcast from Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. This podcast is made possible through support from the members of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club. To learn more about events or membership, visit us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum or join us on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. I am Kathleen Pender of the San Francisco Chronicle. Tonight's topic is surviving the Great Recession. That sounds kind of scary, but these are scary times. Financial institutions are crumbling, housing has skidded off its foundations, stocks are in a bear market. Oil prices are skyrocketing, unemployment is up. Tonight we're going to find out how bad this economy could get and what you should do to prepare for it. We have assembled an impressive panel of experts. Brad Stroh is the managing partner of the Freedom Financial Network and Bills.com, which he co-founded in 2002. He is a 2008 recipient of the Ernst & Young Entrepreneurs Award. Wayne Ellen Cameron is a certified public accountant who specializes in the self-employed taxpayer. He has worked for such firms as KPMG International and PricewaterhouseCoopers, but left the big accounting firms to start his own over 25 years ago. Ellen Hathaway is a partner at Exceptional People, an executive search firm specializing in marketing, sales, business development, and services. She is also heavily involved with such nonprofits as Project Open Hand and Hospitality House. Jeremy Hoover is a vice president and licensed financial consultant with Charles Schwab & Company. For more than a decade, he has helped individual investors reach their financial goals and currently helps clients manage nearly $700 million in assets. And finally, Peter Goslin is the national economics correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and a visiting fellow at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. He is a two-time winner of the George Polk Award, and his newest book, High Wire, The Precarious Financial Lives of American Families, is based on a series of articles he wrote over the last 7 years. Please welcome our panel. Peter, I'm going to start off with you down on the end, because you've been covering the economy for at least a couple of decades, if not more. Where are we headed? Is this going to be a serious recession or even a depression?
Kathleen, the consensus among mainstream economists is that if we could avoid a financial meltdown, this is likely to be an extended but comparatively shallow recession. But I want to make three comments about that. The first is that if is huge. I've been covering the U.S. economy and financial markets for more like three decades, and I've never been so scared as I was in March of this year. A quick story, a Sunday night, I'm about to go downstairs. I look on my email. There is a note from the Fed that they're going to have a conference call. I typed in the number. And who is on the other end but Ben Bernanke? Now, why is Ben Bernanke talking to me on a Sunday night? There has to be something wrong. And we got very close to the edge then, and I think we're getting close to the edge again. Secondly, when economists say that they think this is going to be a shallow recession, they think they're reporting good news. But I would argue they don't really know what they're talking about, because we just don't have very much experience with this kind of recession. Most of our history has been big dips, sharp dips and back out. And finally, I'd just say that working American families are coming to this recession, coming to the doorstep of this recession, uniquely ill-prepared for what they face, bearing a great many more risks than they did a generation ago. And we can talk about that over the course of this panel.
Great. I want to get kind of a broad overview of what some of our panelists think about where we're heading, and then we'll kind of move on to what you should do about it. Jeremy, what's your view on the stock market? We've officially entered a bear market now, yesterday officially by the S&P 500. How long do you see this lasting?
Well, Kathleen, I tell you, my crystal ball is no more accurate than anybody else's. So what we can do is I think we can take a look back at what bear markets have done historically. The average bear market's been about 18 months long. The longest has been about 36 months, about 3 years, and the shortest, about 3 months or so. The good news is, depending on how you look at it, we entered this market downturn in October of 07. I know we've just kind of seen the official 20% correction numbers, but we really started turning down in October. So if we were to go average length of a bear market, that could give us 9 months to a year, and we could be done with it, looking at it that way. So that's the good news. I think what's important for people to remember is what to do in a time like this, and that's not to try and time the market, not to try and say, let's get out of the market now and get back in the market once things recover. I guess the official announcer of recessions in the United States is the National Bureau for Economic Research, or NBER. Historically, they've announced that we're in a recession about 7 or 8 months after it's actually started, and they've announced that we've come out of a recession about 15 months after it's ended. Now, if you were to use that and say, I'm going to get out of the market and I'm going to get back into the market, it would be a terrible mistake, because from the bottom of the market to the time that the NBER, National Bureau for Economic Research, typically says we're done, there's been about a 24% upswing on average from the bottom back to that point.
I've been covering the markets almost as long as Peter's been covering the economy. This seems scary to me. Are you worried at all that this could be like a 1929 type situation where we're going to just get clobbered and take a decade to get back to where we are?
Well, if you look in 1929, I think the markets were down about 80% from 30 to 32. I think it's an interesting thing. The more things change, the more they stay the same. But I do think that we are a different country now with a much more globalized economy, with a much more robust economy, gross domestic policy or product, and great policy in place that I think will keep us out of the really bad trouble that we saw, say, entering a depression like that.
I hope you're right about that. Ellen, what's your take on the job market? Unemployment is 5.5% nationally, and I think it's 6.8% in California, around fifth highest in the nation. Are the employers you work with looking to hire or fire?
Well, I would say that job markets depend on the geography and are regional and not necessarily national. I think in the Bay Area, where I work primarily as well, in the New York market, we have a very heavy sector in technology, which has not been hit as heavily as the financial markets have and housing and whatnot. And with that, there's a lot in the growth industry around green technology as well as biotech. So that insulates us a bit here. I think it's one of our few shining stars right now in the national economy. That's not to say, though, that local employers are not bracing themselves or being much more cautious than they were in previous years. Everyone is trying to be much more focused on what could be coming down the path. So I've seen it slow, but not what I see in the what I'm reading about in the national and other regional markets.
I mean, if there is such thing as a hot job market right now locally, what sector would you say is hot?
I would say there's still a lot going on in the new media arena. You can follow where the venture capitalists and private equity are investing. And I have one firm that I work with is closing a $2.5 billion green tech fund right now that's everything from new fuels to commercial as well as residential energy. It's a really broad arena that I think is going to hopefully help us a bit with the broader energy crisis that we're in. I mean, so I would say technology.
Okay, great. Wayne, you work mostly with self-employed people who are a growing portion of the workforce, especially in the Bay Area. What are you hearing from your small business and self-employed clients about the economy? Are they worried?
Well, I think that, you know, in terms of the self-employed clients that I have, they're not so worried because mainly they're all in service businesses. They're providing really what might be thought of as an outsource from companies, so that more and more companies are not having their in-house things. They're just outsourcing. So they're particularly positioned to continue to do well. I know in terms of numbers, when I became self-employed in 1981, there was about 16 million self-employed people in the United States. That has grown to be 21 million people today, and I think with what may be going on this economy, that's going to grow. I think there's going to be opportunities for you, if you're downsized, to look at being self-employed, and in that, really look at, the discretionary amount of money that's left over. And where is that best spent? So when you look at different, services out there, are you going to want, to really go to a florist, let's say? Are you going to want to go on vacations and things like that? Currently in the market, you look at mortgage brokers, they're having a hard time, real estate agents. So, again, you have to pick, what it is. What is, what service can you really offer?
Okay. Brad. You work with people who are over their heads in debt. Your business must be booming. People desperately need to deleverage themselves, but if they do, what will happen to the economy? Consumer spending is more than two-thirds of GDP. Can we have prudent consumers and economic growth at the same time?
I'd say, Ellen, an industry that is growing is people that work with consumers with debt problems. So if you're looking for growth industries, the answer is probably not. But we don't really have a lot of alternatives. Peter mentioned that we're entering into this sort of economic malaise with a consumer who's uniquely ill-suited to deal with these problems. And you mentioned 1929. The harsh truth is we have the lowest savings rate in this country since 1929. And it's a situation where we have over-levered consumers living beyond their means and assets that aren't rising. Stock market down 20%, home prices, everyone in Northern California is aware, are depressed. The reality, though, is we deal with consumers with debt problems. I wouldn't recommend to any consumer to try to do your part to spend our economy out of a recession. I think in a situation where, wealth is assets less liabilities, assets are not increasing, you've got to do your part to decrease your liability side of the equation. And you had asked about what's a good place to invest. I can tell you a risk-free rate of return that is higher than almost any you will make in the equity markets is to pay off credit card debt. I think a lot of people aren't aware of that. So, my advice would be don't spend beyond your means. Try to get out of debt as quickly as possible and do sort of rational things like work off of a budget, build positive cash flow, and try to build wealth over time. I think that's what will get our economy back to stability and the ability to reinvest in the future.
Are you getting a sense for what people are doing with their economic stimulus checks?
I hope that they're paying down debt. And I do think that a good portion of people do. Unfortunately, I think too many people make financial decisions based on monthly payment. And if they are getting by, I think they're going out and spending it. The people that have severe financial problems or have really done the gut check and done budgeting are hopefully doing the rational thing, which is paying down that high-cost credit card debt.
No, none of you folks sound very panicked. Am I the only one here that kind of is pretty really concerned about where our economy and our country is headed right now? Is anybody think that we could be on the verge of something really serious here?
Look, Kathleen, I don't think you're. I mean, a lot of these people are in businesses that that actually profit from bad times. With all due respect, I mean, they're important of what's happening. I mean, that they're doing well is good for you, but not great for the economy. So this is a very serious time. And I also think this notion that, again, presuming we can avoid financial cataclysm, and we are treading on the edge of it again with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two big government-chartered but shareholder-owned mortgage financiers, whose stock has plummeted again today, it dropped. If those go under, it's inconceivable what that will do to the housing market and to the financial system. It is simply amazing. But even if we do avoid catastrophe, this kind of recession, these times where we slip down, but we don't plummet sharply, but then we take forever coming back up, poses an immense danger to American families. Because one of the things that economists think they're saying when they say, oh, it's going to be shallow, is that, for example, the unemployment rate is not going to get that high. But from the point of view of a household, the danger is just not simply what's the probability that I'll get unemployed, but what's the probability if I get unemployed, it's going to be really bad, I'm going to get stuck out there. And as Ellen said, when you hear the word employers are being cautious, it means that they are taking forever to create new, real, permanent jobs, which means that you can get stuck out in a netherworld of maybe by choice, some subset of Americans choose self-employment, but you can get stuck out there in the netherworld of unjobs, kind of part-time employment, consulting, et cetera, for huge amounts of time. And I don't think most Americans are ready for that.
Well, what do you think, Peter, or any other panelists? You know, I mentioned, we've got inflation, oil, stocks down, housing down, credit crisis. Which of all these things do you think poses the biggest risk to the economy right now? Anybody?
I don't think it's one independently, I would say, is I think those things together are a huge concern. You've got an over-levered consumer, wages, real wages, not rising at the level necessary to keep up with inflation. And the concept of Fannie or Freddie failing, which the federal government couldn't allow them, would be something we couldn't imagine. I mean, homeownership in America would it would be traumatic. But then on top of that, I don't know if anyone's filled up their car recently, we're running a real risk of stagflation like we had in the early 70s that the federal government and monetary policy cannot maneuver us out of, that it could be a long, prolonged situation of recession combined with inflation, that things like China and India and depressed dollar and oil prices prevent us as an economy for the first time ever being able to manage our ways out of, and we just have to deal with serious problems for a long time.
Well, let's go with the premise that we're going to have some kind of ugly recession, maybe not a depression, slow recovery. Peter, what do you think are the top three things people should be doing now to prepare themselves for tough economic times? Should we be planting victory gardens and building chicken coops in our backyard?
Well, let me just say, one of the reasons this is so dangerous for American families is that we don't have most of us don't have the option of doing that. We are not an agricultural economy anymore. We don't have big lots where we could do that. The fact is we depend on paid employment to survive, and that makes us much more vulnerable to economic downturn. The U.S., the big three. I think the number one, and I'm repeating what some of the other panelists say, people simply have to live lower to the ground. You can think of it as sort of financial survivalism. You've got to save more. You've got to get closer to the ground. You've got to avoid exotic financial deals like some of these lunatic mortgages. Okay. The second thing I think that people ought to do is they've got to listen closely and be very vigilant at the workplace about their employer's performance in delivering the benefits that they've promised you. The safety net for most of you is not Medicare and Medicaid. It's not the things that you hear talked about as safety nets. It's your employer-provided benefits. And the fact of the matter is that over the last generation, the Supreme Court and increasingly conservative appeals courts have made a series of rulings that have flipped the one law that governs those benefits, the one federal law, it's called ERISA, on its head, making it easier for employers and insurers to deny benefits. So listen closely. Listen to the stories of your fellow employees about when they've had trouble, and have frank conversations with your employers about who makes the decision, for example. Is it your employer or is it a third party? And finally, I think there are some things we simply have to do together. We are going to have to do something about healthcare together as a society, and I think we're going to have to fix ERISA, by the way, together as a society.
Do you think it's going to make any difference who takes control of the White House and Congress next year as far as these employer safety nets and benefits that you're talking about? Do you see that reversing at all, employers getting more generous with benefits, or is this just a long-term trend that, you know, may have to do with globalization?
Kathleen, you know, you and I are both mainstream media, and we have to come down the middle. I do think it makes a big difference who wins, but I must say that, I mean, I do think that Senator McCain's proposals, take, for example, on health care, push more risk onto families rather than less. But I must say, one of the things that strikes me as amazing is that Senator Obama's campaign has been spectacularly cautious in terms of real policy proposals to cope with the economic security of American families. He's running a very cautious campaign to date. Maybe it's just the early innings, but maybe he thinks that if he just stays, you know, reasonably quiet, he can waltz into the White House. And I wonder whether he's going to have a governing coalition if he does run a campaign that way.
Jeremy, getting back to the stock market, and feel free to talk about other investments if you want to, but where should we be putting our money right now? I know it's really important to be a long-term investor and have a diversified portfolio, but which sectors do you think will be doing best and worst over the next year, and is there anything you wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole?
Sure. I think there is one thing that she just mentioned, that it is 95% of your portfolio's behavior and your ability to reach your goals is driven by your asset allocation and diversification over time. But that's historical and it's boring. So let's talk about stuff that's a little bit more fun, something that you might be able to bring to a cocktail party or call Jim Cramer with. if we look at it, 5% of your portfolio's behavior is going to be predicting the future. So we're going to, again, get out our crystal balls and take a look at where we should be going. And I think I can frame that up two ways: what you shouldn't be doing, and then what you should be doing. Two things that I think long-term investors should not be doing is, number one, keeping their money in cash. And number two, chasing the hottest sectors of the market, which are commodities and energy. So number one, keeping your money in cash. Say you're earning 2% right now. 2% minus taxes, adjusted for inflation, gives you a guaranteed negative return. It's not going to get you to your goals. Guaranteed, we already know it. Chasing the hottest sectors of the market, oil, energy, commodities, they've really run up. And I really believe in reversion to the mean. Things go up, and they come back down to that mean line. We had tulip mania. People paid $1 million for a single tulip bulb. They're crazy. You had more recent times, the tech bubble, and the housing crisis. And both times, it was, no, it's different this time. So I think that the same thing with oil. People say it's different, and we can debate whether it is or not, but I truly believe there will be a reversion to the mean. So those are the two things that I think you should not do. What you should do, I think a lot of people right now, taking a look at, first, the size of the companies they invest in. Most people have domestic large companies. A lot of people have foreign companies because it's been the best performing area in the market the last few years. Their portfolios might have too much international in it. It might be a good time to take some of that foreign off of the table and move it back into small companies. We're consistently seeing investors without enough exposure to small companies, which have underperformed. But you know, things are cyclical. They will get their day in the sun again, and it could come sooner rather than later. As far as sectors, at Charles Schwab, we like healthcare and technology. It's kind of a two-pronged approach. Technology historically has been very volatile, but as we start to come out of recessions, it's performed well. Companies need to spend money on their technology to increase their profits when business is bad. They start investing in technology, and it starts to pay off as the economy recovers. Healthcare, on the other hand, has been very stable historically during times like we're seeing now, during downturns. It's a good place to go to try and earn a consistent return. We think there's some great valuations and opportunities there. As far as what I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole, again, it's got to come back to that oil and commodities. I think that it's probably a good time to take some of the money off the table there. I'm not saying get rid of your whole exposure to energy. Maybe bring it back down in line with the rest of the market. But it's probably run up a good bit lately. Might be a good time to take some of that money off of the table.
Well, thanks, Jeremy, because the two things I feel like doing right now is putting my money in a mattress and putting it in oil. So I guess I won't do that. Ellen, what advice do you have for people who are afraid of losing their jobs or maybe looking for a job right now?
Well, I would say that it's always important to keep your skills and your profile up to date, regardless of how secure your job is, because I think that's personally fulfilling as well as professionally fulfilling. I think that there are a lot of ways to do that, whether it be using new approaches to networking. Again, coming back to technology, it's not just for 20-somethings that there are a lot of online networks that people use now, whether it be LinkedIn, for example. I mean, they've got over 15 million unique users that it's used by CEOs in various industries. And Facebook, for that matter. You know, my nephews and whatnot use it, but I happen to have a Facebook page, and I interface with a lot of my C-level clients who do as well. So it's not just for people in younger generations. It's for every generation. I would say that potentially using a coach to consider going with your strengths and expanding on what your functional and your domain skills are. So maybe you are an accountant or a salesperson and you have strong functional background, but you want to move into a new industry that perhaps is more of a growth industry. How do you move your skills into that? If you're perhaps already part of a layoff and are actively looking for a new opportunity, create a support group and get together with these people on a weekly basis. And don't just get together with people who are in your industry, but something that's combustible, something really shake it up. Bring people in that are it's going to create a challenging conversation and something that's really going to create new ideas and new thought processes. To Peter's point, I think localizing your economy, that, you know, people need to get more back down to saving and back down to earth. I think people can do that in terms of building local economies and looking for business ventures within their own communities. And I think that comes into that there isn't the security of large corporations with pensions and lifetime health care. That just doesn't exist anymore. Or in the cases where it does exist, it's being taken away. So to build your own safety net, I guess, through your own community and whatnot. So
one thing I just might interject here in case people don't know about it is that a law was just passed that provides an extra 13 weeks of unemployment benefits to people who have already used up their initial benefits, which in a lot of cases are 26 weeks. So if you've had a half a year of benefits that ran out, if you became unemployed any time back to 2006, even, you can qualify for these. So just if anybody's out there and ran through their benefits, they might be eligible for some new ones. So one good piece of good news for folks. Wayne, if I was afraid of my job, of losing my job, and this is not a theoretical question because I do work in the newspaper industry, but if I was afraid of losing my job and thinking about becoming self-employed, what kind of temperament, skills, or talents would I need to succeed?
Excellent question. First thing is that it's very, you know, exciting and scary at the same time. I mean, the whole thing of working with, you know, no safety net underneath you to go out there and blaze in your own trail. What I thought about in terms of my clients, trying to build a profile of what really is the characteristics of a successful client of mine, and the first part really is success. When you're self-employed, you get to define what success is. I think that too much in America, we, you know, always define success by making a ton of money, and then the next year you have to make more. When you're self-employed, you get this new barometer of what success is. It's your own. And with that, it gives you this freedom. Freedom to take a job, take a client, you know, work on a project that you want to get behind. And the opposite freedom is to say no. I mean, just imagine being an employee and, you know, your boss says, you know, here. You say, oh, no, boss, you know, I don't want to do it. You have to do it. And it's just, you know, so liberating to be in that position. Another thing is to understand that you need to differentiate yourself in the marketplace. And how do you do that? It's the uniqueness of your individuality, what you really bring, you know, to the job, to the service that you're providing. And with that, that's creativity. And, you know, there's really no end, you know, to that level and the uniqueness of who you are. Another beauty of being self-employed is that you get to balance work with your life. I mean, it really gets down to that basic tenet is, you know, are you living to work or working to live? And you get this nice balance the way you want. Another factor that I have of success is you can grow your business as large as you want. If you're content with the way it is, you can keep that. Second big point that I have is accountability. And basically that's, you know, doing the right thing and do it well. First thing is really an ethical part of that is, you know, exactly what are you doing? Other aspect of that is really no cutting corners. It's really in how you do your work. Your reputation is everything, you know, when you're self-employed, and it's always about, you know, how you're doing your job with the quality. Veracity, it's all about you've made a promise to your client. That means to do the job, you know, in an excellent manner and on time. Third part that I have here are the actual characteristics. And the first is the most telling. It's passion. I mean, you really have to be passionate about, you know, what it is. You can't just kind of limp through what you're doing. Your clients, prospective clients are going to, you know, pick up on that. You have to believe in yourself, you know, with that foundation that I'm never going to give up. You have to possess a joy of learning. It's just incredible. You know, the more you get into it, the more you want to get into it. And with that learning, you're going to have the ability to adapt to new situations and implement those learning process. Another thing you're going to have to become comfortable with is technology. I mean, it's just amazing what's out there, and you use it to learn about, you know, more about, you know, what you do so you can serve your clients better. You also connect with, you know, clients, colleagues, and also, you know, you learn to just augment, you know, your learning as opposed to taking, you know, seminars. And another thing is, my clients that are successful, they learn to act quickly. Circumstances change, they change with that and implement those changes. And the last thing that I have here, and it goes back to an accounting professor I had at the University of Connecticut, and he said, you can't eat accounts receivables. And the point here is get paid.
Get paid up front, hopefully.
That's right.
You know, I think self-employment appeals to an awful lot of people, but right now I think the thing that holds a lot of people back is health care. You know, the thought of going without employer-provided health care, that would be scary to me, especially, you know, if you're a little older in age and you've ever seen a doctor for any kind of problem, you're now uninsurable. Any of the panelists, how are we going to cope with that? Should we hold on to our jobs, even if we hate them, just to keep that employer-provided health care?
Well, you can. There's independent insurance brokers, medical insurance brokers that you can go to, and they can formulate an exact package that you have. One of the things in tax law is allows you to have a medical savings account, so you get these very reasonable rate insurance plans, and the premiums that you pay are going to be tax deductible, and then you put a portion, now it's 100% of your premiums, into what amounts to be like an IRA account that sits there, and as you would need, you know, your medical insurance, you know, before, you know, the part kicks in, you can use that part of your medical savings account. So it's a very affordable way to do it, so you don't have to be so scared about having your employer pay for
well,
your...
Well, when I hear what my self-employed friends are paying for health insurance, mm-hmm. It just curls my toes.
Yep.
Peter, did you want to...
Yeah, look, let me just make this point. A lot of what you're hearing tonight are techniques of necessity. We are at a point with the United States economy where some of these techniques have to be used. But just on to Wayne's point, It takes a very unique person, and it is a subset of a subset of a subset of people who can go out on their own. Mm-hmm. The danger that Kathleen raises about healthcare, there is no market in this country that's there is almost no market in this country that's more screwed up than the individual healthcare market. And the notion that you can save in some tax-advantaged account to actually be able to bear a major medical event is simply wrong. With the cost of health care, not health insurance, health the actual care. So when you listen to these speakers, understand that we are in effect, we are showing you how much the economy has changed. Jeremy says, don't put your money in cash. Actually, cash sounds rather good to me, but I'm a cautious kind of guy. But we are dependent on financial markets that basically won't even, if you put a dollar in 9 years ago in a major, like an index fund, you couldn't get your principal back today. It would have been eroded. You can network to a fare-thee-well, as Ellen suggests, and still, you can get stuck out there, particularly if this economy goes down. And finally, if you do have the temperament to be an entrepreneur and go on your own, more power to you. But Americans, many, many Americans do not have that temperament. And they've shown it. They've shown it in the way we performed in one area, which is a retirement savings. A large fraction of people have made a hash of their retirement savings. And indeed, in one of the people in the book that Kathleen mentioned that I just wrote, I went out and I interviewed all the living Nobel Prize winners in economics, and I asked them what they did for their retirement. And the guy who brought you the notion of diversification, Harry Markowitz, the father of modern portfolio theory, didn't diversify, you know? And what he said was, I got a life to lead. I had other things to do, you know? And that's true of most Americans.
Think about how much better he could have done.
You mean better than the Nobel Prize?
I think if I could, I'd just say one thing, and he is right. If you had invested in just, say, the S&P 500, you might be about break-even today or even have lost money. But if you had maintained a well-diversified portfolio that included international companies, that included small companies, that perhaps had a small exposure, 5% or so, to commodities and energy markets, bonds, and a little bit of cash, guess what? You wouldn't have negative returns today. You would have still been on track to meet your goals. So just, he is right, though, about the S&P 500, but there's other areas of the market that have done well.
Well, Brad, I'd like to get one more question in about debt, since it's such a big subject. What advice do you have for people who are really struggling with their debts? Is bankruptcy the answer, or has the new bankruptcy law closed off that option for most people?
You still have options. Bankruptcy reform certainly makes it a lot more challenging for people to file for Chapter 7. Chapter 13 is sort of where the Republican Congress and President have pushed people towards to repay the banking industry at the expense of the consumer and entrepreneur. But I'd say before even looking at options is what you really should do is do a gut check and figure out where you are. Pull your credit. You should pull your credit once a year. See what's on there. Make sure you understand what's on there. If you have high balances relative to your limits, anything over about a third of your credit limit, if you owe, that's going to negatively impact your credit rating. And then do a budget, like I said earlier, and figure out what your cash flow is. Work very hard if you're in debt for as long as it takes to cut back on the lattes and cut back on the dinners and movies and try to fill up your tank a little less and use that available free cash flow to pay down those debts. If at the end of the month and you really do stick to a budget, you figure out that you do have negative cash flow and a significant chunk of that is going to pay off unsecured debts or secured debts, which maybe have turned into unsecured debts because your home's underwater, it really is time to do that serious gut check and figure out what your alternatives are. You could go and seek bankruptcy counseling, see if you qualify for a Chapter 7. Frankly, now with post-bankruptcy reform, if you make more than the median income in the state, you won't qualify for a 7, which is a traditional liquidation. You're going to have to repay your debts over 5 years through a 13. If you have the ability to repay 25% of your debts and some other hurdles, you will not qualify for a 7. There's also traditional nonprofit credit counselors who, don't be fooled, do actually make money, and the vast majority of them are not really serving directly the consumer, but they can get interest rate concessions and monthly payment reductions, which should allow you to compound and put more of your cash flow into paying those debts down. And typically that program takes about 5 years. And then there's programs called negotiated debt settlement, which is for people that have severe problems, but Chapter 7 is not the right alternative. So first, figure out what you can self-manage. If you realize that your cash flow is negative even after tightening the belt, seek third-party help and kind of figure out, based on what's available freely in your monthly cash flow, what alternative is right for you.
The folks that come through your shop, what would you say is the main reason people get in trouble with their debt? Is it some kind of life event, like a major medical problem or a layoff, or is it just simple overspending?
I think the cause of the problem a lot of times is overspending caused by many things. Could be medical hardship, could be overspending, could be a variety of issues. Very frequently we see situations, our average client has $30,000 of credit card debt, so it's not a small amount, it's a more severe financial problem. And most people are making these financial decisions and just barely able to make their monthly payments. And then one of three things for our client base happens is serious medical hardship, where they can't afford their premiums and can't afford to pay those medical expenses, and the whole thing unravels. Divorce or loss of a job or loss of income, which prevents them from the ability to keep paying those debts, and the whole thing can unravel very quickly.
We're going to open up the panel to questions in just a minute, so if you have something that you'd like to ask the panel, please start lining up in the mic over there now, and we'll get to you in just a minute. I would probably be remiss if I didn't ask one question about everybody's favorite investment, or used to be favorite investment, especially around here, the housing market. You know, at the Chronicle, we have a really hard time writing about the housing market because we really have about 100 housing markets in our circulation area, areas like out in Antioch, which are just, you know, among the worst, whereas San Francisco, you hardly know there's been a housing crisis. Do any of your folks have an idea where this market is going, and will we ever see the kind of housing mania again that we saw the last few years?
I'll take a crack at it first. I don't think we're going to see a housing bubble again in the very foreseeable future. There's been too much structural change in the mortgage industry, and I don't think we'll ever see it again. I would say, while housing is severely depressed, you know, down 20% in some markets, you know, Central Valley down much more than that, there's an interesting thing about housing which still makes it a valued investment, is I think consumers generally, it's challenging to save. One great thing about a mortgage is it's a forced savings vehicle. Every month, you are forced to pay down a portion of that debt, which in theory will build equity, all things held constant. If you aren't a homeowner, try to figure out ways to force those savings vehicles. It wasn't mentioned tonight, but if your 401k plan is matched by your employer, that is free money, and you have to max that out. And it's really unfortunate that a lot of people don't make that decision. 529 plans, if you have children, you have to contribute to those. That is free tax, pre-tax dollars that is being given to you. That I don't think we'll see a bubble again in our lifetime, but I think people should work hard to get forced savings vehicles in place in lieu of that.
Can I just say one thing? I mean, the traditional mortgage was a marvelous forced savings mechanism. But the truth is that the inventions that we put on top of it have basically taken that away. I mean, yes, we participated in the taking of it away, but I don't know what sort of equity position, whether somebody can summarize the equity position of Americans in their households now, but I'll bet it's less than it was a generation ago.
I think they've estimated that up to 40% of the $7 billion of subprime loans are going to default in the next 2 years. So these exotic loans, the option arms, negative AM loans, they're crazy. That's not a forced savings vehicle, and it was a lot of speculation and greed on parts of some consumers, but certainly on lenders. I think Congress is working on this. In fact, they were working on it today to preclude exotic loans to subprime consumers ever again. Traditional, you know, 30-year fixed loans, great forced savings vehicle.
But to your point, those loans haven't matured yet, so we haven't seen the end of this. Yeah.
Okay, let's turn to the audience. What you got for the panel?
I was especially curious about Jeremy's comments, his assumptions that it's likely to see a correction in the commodities markets, specifically energy, oil, maybe with a special light shined on the rapid industrialization of China and India.
Mm-hmm. So what other than kind of looking at charts and doing technical analysis are you basing that assumption
on?
Thank you.
I think there's a couple of things to look at there. Take China, for instance. Their markets have historically been a very good indicator of where the price of energy is going. As if you can go back, and I know this is chart-based, but you go back and you look at what has happened with China's economy. Has it grown or has it contracted? Historically, it's been a leading indicator of energy prices. Right now, China's markets are down nearly 50%. And I do realize that the Chinese are, that they're 75% of the growth in oil demand is coming from China and India right now. If you take a look at that, though, that number has been coming down. They are getting rid of much of the energy subsidies that they've had in their countries to help slow down the pace of economic growth because they're worried about inflation. Those both add into potential decreases in demand for oil. Here in the United States, say we're down 3 or 4% year-to-date in our demand. That doesn't sound like enough to fix the problem, but it starts to add up. If our economy begins to strengthen, the world economies continue to get weaker. The decoupling that a lot of people think have happened is not as strong, I don't believe, as what many do. When we get sick, the rest of the world still gets sick. When these emerging markets do slow, that leads to more supply. The value of the dollar can come back up, which then could also start to harm, you know, start to bring these down. And I'm not saying when it's going to happen. I'm just saying these are factors that could contribute to it happening.
But when you say down, it's the Chinese stock market is down 50%.
The Chinese stock market is
GDP
down.
GDP growth is down from 12% to 9% in China. And you fundamentally have supply and demand imbalances in commodities right now that I don't know that it's oil at $150. I cannot fathom getting back to $60 a barrel.
Yeah, I'm
short term versus long term.
I don't know where prices are going to come back down to. I really don't. And I don't know. I'm not going to pretend to say this is how high they're going to go. The market is valuing large oil companies right now, like oil is trading at about $75 a barrel. Something to think about. The market oftentimes is a leading indicator of where oil prices are going to go. But, you know, we can bring up lots of points to both topics, but I do believe, and again, reversion to the mean, oil prices have come up so much that I believe they'll correct. Oil commodities contracts, let's not talk about just hedging futures, but speculative over-the-counter options contracts, have increased eightfold over the last 4 years. It's been a huge increase in the amount of trading, in speculative trading that's driven prices up also.
Can I just add one comment? And this does not, I do not hold myself out to be a financial advisor of any sort, so I don't know where this points you in terms of what you choose as an investment. But just remember what we thought the global economy was going to look like just 10 years ago, just as we entered this century. We thought it was going to be, certainly for us, high tech, and it was going to be brain jobs. And guess what it is? It's a stuff economy. It's oil and cotton and copper and all those things. It looks amazingly like our 19th century. And there's a good reason for that, which is the rest of the world is industrializing. And I must say that traders may have run ahead of the trend, but the global trend is to have another 19th century. And if they're going to buy a hell of a lot of steel and pig iron and basic commodities, and they're going to do it for a very long time.
Didn't you write an article about this is your grandfather's economy?
I did. He had a good line in an article.
Hey, a quick reminder to our audience, this is the Commonwealth Club's Inforum program, and tonight we're discussing surviving the Great Recession. I'm Kathleen Pender, net worth columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. We also have Brad Stroh, managing partner and co-founder, Freedom Financial Network and Bills.com. Wayne Cameron, MBA and CPA, Wayne Cameron Associates. Ellen Hathaway, partner, Exceptional People, Inc. Jeremy Hoover, vice president, financial consultant with Charles Schwab and Company. And Peter Goslin, national economics correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Fellow at the Urban Institute and author of High Wire, The Precarious Financial Lives of American Families. We'll get back to our next question.
Thank you. I'm not sure who on the panel this question is for, and it's not so much a tactical question about what I or any person does, but about the perspective of the economy. And back to the point about the economy being 70% or more than two-thirds consumer-based, there was a fellow here Tuesday night talking about middle-class millionaires. He said that of those 70 points of the consumer, of the economy driven by consumers, 39 points of that was this 10% of the households in the country that are net worth between a million and 10 million who drive a lot of that consumption. I would guess that those people are pretty well insulated from prices of gas because they live in places where they don't drive as much as in the rest of the country. They may telecommute, things like that. They may be self-employed and don't drive a lot. They also may be more insulated from a lot of the financial crisis that a lot of the economy is hit, or a lot of the households are hit with. So I guess my question is if it's consumer-based and more than half of it's driven by a group that might be insulated, what's your perspective on that? Is there any saving grace in the sense that, for better or for worse, a big chunk of the people who are driving the economy, or at least a large chunk of it, I don't know, do you guys see them as being somewhat more insulated, and is that anything to take comfort in for the economy as a whole?
Who wants to tackle that one?
I mean, I think they'd be more insulated from winding up in serious debt problems. They are probably also, you get home prices down 20%. Maybe you've got multiple homes. You've got the stock market down 20%, China down 50%. That's going to negatively impact people's asset levels and propensity to spend pretty dramatically. Now, on day-to-day necessities, that won't impact them. But even at the luxury market, which over the past 12, 18 months has been relatively sustained, mm-hmm. we're seeing this year big cracks in luxury spending, too. I think you have one, a super extreme, which is not the 39%, but maybe the top, 5%, totally insulated. But I think the we're ending up in an economy, unfortunately, this housing thing is what built the millionaire middle class. I think we're ending up in an economy here where it gets split into a dichotomy between the haves and the have-nots. And the haves, they have some pain, but they're surviving. The have-nots, it's worse than ever.
Let me just say, though, that I do think that a fairly substantial chunk of the haves, let's say a million of wealth is a have, are still, and maybe I'm just repeating what Ben said, are still terribly vulnerable to the forces that are at play, they're playing havoc for the rest of us. So that there clearly are people who have so much in wealth and income, they are padded, they are self-insured. But that turns out to be, a much smaller fraction of the American population than you might think. And if I understood your question correctly, the suggestion is that sort of there is such a heavy 10% that they could keep the thing going. And if it turns out that only a very small slice of that the 10% that do a lot of the consumption are insulated from these forces, then I don't think we can have hope that our aggregate number for gross domestic product will keep rising.
Well, there's definitely a have and have not. I was thinking about this panel today, Surviving the Great Recession, and there was a story in the Journal this morning about how spas are adding treatment for kids, junior highs getting massages and facials and manicures. It's just kind of like sounds like a disconnect here. Anyway, next question.
Yeah, I have a question for either Peter or really anybody on the panel. I'd like to hear their response to the view that the increased role of the government over the last 50 years has enabled it to kind of smooth out the crises in the economy, such as what we saw in 1929. But it's been done at the cost of vastly inflating the money supply, which means an increased tendency towards inflation. And this has been done really to combat the tendency to overproduction. So now, and I think this was clearly visible 9-10 months ago, we're facing a stagflation that will really put what we saw in the late 70s to shame. And compounding that is the constrictions in oil supplies, which tends to confirm the peak oil theories, and also the economic effects of global warming, which we're seeing in forest fires food shortages and drought and so on.
Whoa.
Didn't write down all that. Yeah.
Let me answer pieces of that puzzle, right? I think that the government clearly has developed tools for managing that did well for a period of time managing the economy. There's a great chart that shows basically panics and recessions sort of for over 200 years. And it's like one of those barcodes that they have on things, right? And sort of pre-1930, there are things every few years. You know, we had a panic of a decade, right? I mean, or several panics a decade. And it really did thin out. But I don't think two things. One is the current economic situation, as much as we may have tried to not cry fire in the theater, is showing itself to be really quite resistant to the traditional mechanisms for managing the economy. And that's why the Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke is inventing stuff on the fly, because it just doesn't work. And the other thing is that I don't think you can say that stagflation is the product of government policy. I mean, the reason why these commodities are going up at the end of the day is neither government policy nor speculators. It's we have a global industrialization going on, and it's demanding lots of stuff.
Kind of curious your viewpoint on the quasi bailout of Bear Stearns and what kind of dangerous precedent that may set in the future.
I think it's a disaster. There's testimony today, I'm sure you guys heard, but you create this concept of moral hazard, which is frankly one of the major causes of the mortgage meltdown. You end up with mortgage-backed securities and credit default markets that no one understands, and investment bankers make tens of millions of dollars swapping these things and selling them. And ultimately, no, they're not going to let Bear Stearns fail. They're not going to let Fannie or Freddie fail. And you lose a sense of accountability. And then when you have a global investment market where, you know, this has been in the news, where, you know, cities in Greenland are going bankrupt because of the U.S. mortgage meltdown, because they are investors in these credit swap derivatives that no one understood, this moral hazard problem becomes very severe, and you'd lose all accountability in the financial system, which is why, you know, this morning you heard a lot of testimony from Bernanke and Paulson saying they have to let banks fail, they have to let investment banks fail, and force accountability onto these organizations. Now, I would say Fannie and Freddie need to be an exception to that, but I think it's a disaster. I think, you know, we're a capitalist economy where free markets should work themselves out, and things should fail and things should succeed, and artificial support create long-term problems in the system.
Well, they can say they're going to let institutions fail, but do you really think they're going to do it other than, you know, the community banks here and there?
Brad, I must say that, I mean, so is what you are saying that they should have just let Bear Stearns go down? And let's just take it forward. Should they let Fannie and Freddie go?
No, I think Fannie and Freddie are an exception. That guarantees U.S. home ownership. That is a government-backed and secured entity, those two entities, okay? Sally included on the student loan side. But I'll go out and start up an investment bank and sell you guys the riskiest securities there are. Not my problem. If I make money, it's a call to call. If I make money, I make it. If I lose it, your problem. Well, as a taxpayer, I don't advocate that.
The notion of moral hazard is that markets can self-regulate, and so that if the risk sits with the maker of decisions, then they'll be penalized. But what you heard Bernanke and Paulson saying today is, you know what? Markets don't do a very good job of self-regulating, and we're going to have to start regulating not just banks. We're going to have to start regulating the broad financial markets. It seems to me that what we're really doing here is we've seen the limits of moral hazard. It doesn't do a very good job of keeping markets stable enough that people can live actual lives.
Well, I think I would agree with on both sides. I think the moral hazard concept is still there. You need regulation and visibility into these financial instruments, and ultimately accountability, which was totally lost in this cycle.
I think if I could add in on that, I do agree that we don't want to create moral hazard in the marketplace. I do think that the government stepping in and saving Bear Stearns was probably the right thing to do at that point. I think our markets could have gotten much, much worse if they had not. And I think it also shows, I know I might sound like the optimistic one up here tonight, but it also shows the government's willingness to try and save our financial system, to keep the system from wrecking. Now, what tools they have and how successful they're going to be, I don't know, but we can see that they have a willingness to try and do the job, and I think that was important.
But they could have also taken that money and helped in the housing bailout rather than bailing out the institution and letting the markets adjust themselves.
I believe that there could have been a much greater destruction of wealth by letting that company fail and then trying to bail out individual homeowners. I think our problems could have got significantly worse had a prime broker like Bear Stearns been allowed to just fail. I think they might have gotten off cheap by bailing them out.
But Congress is still stuck in terms of offering any real bailouts to the homeowners, and they're still, you know, holding the bag.
Next question.
Hi. One thing that really concerns me that I have not heard addressed directly by this forum is this idea of peak oil, which is this concept of, like, oil is a finite resource, and whenever we've tried to harvest it, it always follows like a bell curve where it goes up and then then it runs out. And sometimes the running out is very precipitous. And by people, I've heard a lot of this on like CNN and like talk shows, and people who are studying this say that we haven't had a big discovery, oil discovery, for like the last few decades. And the United States has peaked in its production. Various other countries have peaked, and maybe Saudi Arabia may have peaked already. And there's no other good energy to take over. Hydrogen economy is like maybe 30 to 50 years off. Solar energy is really expensive. I mean, today's development, what I heard is that potentially they can, you know, focus sunlight into solar energy, solar cells, which might make them 10 times more productive. I mean, that's encouraging. But there doesn't seem to be any good solution to this. And, of course, oil, our whole economy runs off of oil. Stuff is created from oil, transported by oil. And, you know, I've heard people say that, like, you know, a kid born today is not going to need a driver's license because gas is going to be way too expensive. And one thing that troubles me a lot about this is that in the United States, we have 5% of the world's population that consumes 25% of the world's resources. Mm-hmm. This suggests that greater, you know, demand for oil, potentially decreasing supply. We live in a society that is so heavily based upon consumption of oil and cheap energy that we're going to have to make perhaps the greatest change in our lifestyles than any other country. And I think this is also going to really bring down our economy majorly. Okay. I mean, that's what concerns me. And
did you have a specific question about
right?
Peak
I mean,
oil?
What's the counter argument to that? Is it like, do you guys have a counter argument?
I mean that's supply and demand. And I think if we stay focused on our primary supply of energy is oil, we are going to run out of it. So you know, it's the necessity is the mother of invention. We're going to have to figure out how to get demand destruction, which is to get off of oil and move on to other resources. You know, I don't know what that is, but certainly nuclear, solar, wind, if we remain this addicted to oil.
Well, I think we're going to have problems. Oil at $140 a barrel is probably going to hasten some of those new technologies, hopefully.
Right. It's finally reached a point where it is cost-effective. And if you look at where all the private equity and venture funding is going into, billions of dollars in alternative energy, it's not going to replace our demand. So I think it's a multifold approach to we're going to change our lifestyle in our lifetime. But I do think American innovation, technology, I know I've been beating that drum, but this is where we live and how I've made my career over the past 30 years. And I really do think that is going to be part of our solution.
Let's try to squeeze in a couple more questions. Next.
I've been going back and reading as much as I could about Greenspan and what he was like and what some of his philosophies were. And I don't hear much talk about what I feel may have happened, which was after the tech bubble and 9/11, money was made so cheap. And I feel like it has to do with the administration and 9/11 and fear. And, you know, I keep remembering go out and spend money was the solution to what was going on. And
still is.
And right. And it just seemed like he was so complicit. Greenspan was so complicit in making money so cheap that that's why we're here tonight, to me. And it had such a global impact. You know, of course, money's cheap as it is. We're going to buy stuff from all over the world. I'm wondering why, you know, and of course he had the maestro. You know, he got the nickname that he was just this genius.
Would anybody disagree with his premise that cheap money for so long contributed to where we are today? Would anybody disagree with that?
Yeah, I do think I think Mr. Greenspan's reputation is taking a hit because arguably it's not one bubble, it's two bubbles. I mean, he really kept rates low in the late 90s when the economy was growing faster and faster and faster and when tech was going up and up and up. Arguably, that was a mistake. And the other thing is that he was extraordinarily resistant to the Fed using its regulatory powers in areas like subprime. I had the honor of sitting in the office right next to the former governor of the Fed, Ned Gramlich, who just before he died, but after he'd left the Fed, wrote a book that basically said, here are all my memos. Here is what I was saying about subprime and all in the early 00s. And we knew it was dangerous. And we knew certainly after 2003, 2004 that we were going right off the tracks. And the Fed had the power to step in to these markets and start regulating. They have a sort of broad regulatory authorities in the areas. They didn't do it.
We're going to have to close it off now. If you have any questions, the panelists will probably be around afterwards if you want to come up and ask anyone individually. But let's give a big hand to the panelists for their thoughts here tonight. Now, this meeting of Inforum is now adjourned at the Commonwealth Club. Thanks for coming.